This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 21st, 2008. From Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Aura Abogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear how new voters could swing North Carolina away from its three-decade-long history of voting Republican. We'll visit the tunnels under Egypt's border with Gaza to see how Gazans are digging their way around the Israeli blockade. And we'll go to the line of control in Kashmir, where trade routes between India and Pakistan have reopened for the first time since 1947. All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. military has dropped charges against five Guantanamo Bay detainees, but reserves the right to renew the charges at a later date. One of them is British resident Binyam Mohammed. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Charges were dropped because U.S. military prosecutor Lieutenant Colonel Daryl Vandervelt resigned, complaining that the military was suppressing evidence that would help Binyam Mohammed's case. According to Mr. Mohammed, he was tortured in Morocco and Afghanistan via so-called extraordinary rendition before ending up in Guantanamo prison. Lawyers from the legal charity Reprieve representing Mr. Mohammed are still fighting for the release of secret government documents that they say prove it. But the Pentagon says it intends to refile charges against him within 30 days with new military prosecutors. Binyam Mohammed is said to be contemplating suicide. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A U.S. federal appeals court today blocked the release of 17 Chinese Muslim Uyghurs from the Guantanamo Bay prison. The men have been held without charge for more than 6 years. 2 weeks ago, a federal judge ordered they be released and brought to Washington, D.C., the home to a significant Uyghur community. Today's reversal was in response to a U.S. government request. Arguments will be held in late November. And yesterday marked 7 years behind bars for Hassan Almre, a Canadian of Syrian origin. He's been held without charge or trial. Aaron Lakoff has more.
Almre is the last remaining person in detention under a security certificate, a measure which the Supreme Court of Canada ruled was unconstitutional in 2007. Since then, he has been held at the Millhaven Detention Center in southern Ontario, which many have dubbed Guantanamo North. Despite being granted refugee status in 2000, the Canadian government is still trying to deport Almre to his native Syria, where he, like the now famous Maher Arar, could likely face torture. For FSRN, this is Aaron Lakoff.
Bolivia's National Congress has agreed to hold a constitutional referendum next January. Lenny Oliveira is in Cochabamba.
Bolivian voters will approve or reject the new political constitution of the state, written by the Constituent Assembly. A new constitution was one of the President Evo Morales' main proposals when he was elected in 2006. The new document's Bill of Rights gives indigenous groups autonomy over their traditional lands and a priority share of the country's natural resources wealth. It also limits Morales to just one more term. Congress agreed to the vote after thousands of indigenous people and social organizations marched 2 kilometers to Bolivia's capital, La Paz, calling for the referendum. Indigenous Bolivians have been politically excluded for hundreds of years in Bolivia, despite being the majority of the population. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Oliveira from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
A former Chicago police officer accused of torturing and abusing suspects was arrested in Florida today. WMNF's Sean Canan has more.
Commander John Burge was arrested today at his home in Apollo Beach, Florida, and charged with 2 counts of obstruction of justice and 1 of perjury. An indictment unsealed today accuses Burge, who was fired in 1993, of lying about whether he and others under his command abused and tortured suspects in custody as far back as the 1980s. Burge stands accused of using cattle prods to shock suspects and conducting mock executions. Earlier this year, the Chicago City Council awarded $20 million to 4 African-American former death row inmates who alleged that Burge and his subordinates coerced them into making false confessions. From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Sean Canan for FSRN.
Embattled United States Prosecutor Scott Block will step down from his post after the first of the year. Peter Granitz reports from Washington, D.C.
Block headed up the Office of Special Counsel, a little-known federal agency that protects government whistleblowers. He's under investigation, though, for potentially retaliating against his own employees for alerting the government to his own wrongdoings. The FBI raided his office and home as part of the investigation amid claims that he destroyed evidence. President Bush nominated Block to the 5-year term, and in 2004, the Republican-controlled Senate approved his nomination. Since then, he's been at the center of many controversies, including being accused of closing federal cases without investigating them and refusing to protect gay and lesbian federal employees from discrimination. He could have chosen to stay in his position for up to a year until the Senate confirmed his replacement. In yesterday's letter to President Bush, Block made little mention of the ongoing controversy. He did say that doing the right thing will attract fire from both sides. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Peter Granitz in Washington.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
As November 4th rapidly approaches, groups across the nation are working to ensure a fair and accurate election. While allegations of voter fraud still loom in the headlines, organizers on the ground are more concerned with ensuring Americans can get to the polls, cast their ballots, and know that their votes are counted. Election watchdog groups are also out in full force on the lookout for irregularities. Catherine Jarmel has more from Washington, D.C.
Only a few weeks after Acorn hit the national news for allegations of voter fraud, police arrested the leader of a California group registering Republicans to vote over the weekend. The Los Angeles District Attorney's Office says Mark Jacoby is under investigation for voter fraud and perjury. And Los Angeles and Ventura residents accuse his group, the Young Political Majors, of misleading citizens to register as Republicans by saying they were signing a petition to stop child molestation. Citizens from Florida, Massachusetts, and California have also accused the group, which is paid by the state's Republican Party to collect registration, of the same tactics in 2004. The California GOP has called the accusations partisan. But some say allegations of voter fraud are overblown and work to undermine voter turnout. Ian Inaba is co-founder of Video the Vote and videographer of American Blackout, a film documenting voting irregularities in 2000 and 2004.
I really feel like the story of voter fraud, which has gotten so much press lately, really obfuscates the real problem here, which is that there are tactics and there are measures being put in place to attempt to deal with this supposed problem of voter fraud, and these tactics are going to end up suppressing voters, and that is the real problem that we face here in 2008.
Inaba formed Video the Vote in 2006 to help monitor elections after seeing so many citizens in 2000 and 2004 who felt their voting experience and the media coverage let them down. Video the Vote is now present in every state except South Dakota and will be out in full force on November 4th to document voters' experiences. Inaba says their role is essential.
It's just the case that on Election Day, there are so many problems that happen across the country, and there just simply aren't enough paid journalists to cover these stories. And so we think it's important that citizens actually monitor the elections in their local areas.
More than 2,200 trained volunteers for Video the Vote will be looking for specific concerns, such as longer lines and mechanical failure. This comes amid growing concerns in battleground states like Virginia, where hundreds of thousands of people have registered to vote within recent months. Inaba explains.
In those types of states, a lot of the allocations for the voting machines have been made on past turnout expectations. And so what we're going to see this year is that there's going to be lines like you've seen in Ohio in a lot of places.
Michael Slater is the executive director for Project Vote, a group that seeks to encourage low-income and minority communities to vote. He says partisan elements launched a war on new registrants in 2004, and Project Vote was one of the organizations willing to fight back.
There's been an effort really to hold the Department of Justice accountable to its mission of protecting Americans, and particularly Americans of color, so that they can register and vote without fear of harassment or intimidation.
Project Vote is focused in many battleground states, including Colorado, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and hopes to encourage 1 million Americans to come out and vote by helping to ensure legislation that allows easier registration and lifting restrictions on voter registration drives. Slater says they've been contacting election officials about voter turnout on Election Day and hopes the officials will take the necessary steps to ensure every vote is counted.
We expect precincts and voting districts that have historically low turnout to have much higher turnout. We want to make sure that election officials are prepared for that with an adequate number of ballots, with emergency procedures in case something goes wrong, with an adequate number of polling machines, We also want to make sure that election officials have properly trained poll workers so they know how to handle new voters, particularly. They know how to handle problems at the polls in case someone is challenged or we have partisan observers who are behaving inappropriately.
Bev Harris founded one of the first election count watchdog groups, Black Box Voting, in 2004. She says it's important to watch the vote, but that the count is just as, if not more, important.
In the U.S., we're not exactly one size fits all. In the Northwest, we have our mail-in voting, and in New England, there's a lot of hand count and town-level counting. So we've addressed each kind of system and given very simple and specific tasks for the public to do to go out and oversee that count, because we don't want everyone just watching the voting. We want people watching the counting. That is actually arguably the most important part.
Harris says the group will be looking specifically at the chain of custody for ballots, making sure all ballots are sealed correctly and that the seals haven't been broken, and making sure electronic records add up. She says that every voter has an obligation to ensure a proper vote.
I think the most important thing people should be doing is getting involved and making sure the numbers add up. This sounds like such a simple thing, but quite often when you actually look at all of the numbers, the sum doesn't total the individual numbers. Make sure that when you see something weird, don't just assume someone else is getting it.
As Election Day approaches, safeguards, both legal and community-based, will be enacted to ensure the election is as fair and as accurate as possible. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in D.C.
North Carolina has become a battleground state this election. As the presidential race has tightened in recent weeks, Republican John McCain has been forced to go on the defensive to hold ground in what has been Republican turf for the past 32 years. The shift has also put the heat on North Carolina's incumbent senators, FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
George Bush won North Carolina in 2000 and 2004 with 56% of the vote. Not since Jimmy Carter's 1976 win has North Carolina voted for a Democrat for president.
Democrats have dominated locally continuously. Even in 93, we did not lose every office like many in the South did. So when people say go blue, what they're really saying is, are we going to vote for the Democratic president this time around?
Chris Lezak, National Chair of Progressive Democrats of North Carolina.
You know, we have a Democratic governor, and we control the General Assembly. It's just really at the national level, the Senate seats, many of the House seats, and the president that defines us as a red state.
This year, Democratic support could trickle up. Recent polls suggest McCain and Obama are tied. John McCain must now pay more attention to the state that Republicans have long taken for granted. He and his running mate Sarah Palin separately visited the state in the past week. Hoping to capitalize on dissatisfaction with the president, the economic crisis, and the 20% of African Americans living in the state, Barack Obama traveled to Fayetteville Sunday. He spoke to a sold-out crowd of 10,000, with thousands listening outside through loudspeakers. In this historically conservative town, a white minivan has its windows painted, "Welcome Home from Iraq." The car in front of it has a U.S. Army bumper sticker. Common adornments in this military town, home to Fort Bragg Military Base and Pope Air Force Base. Here's Fayetteville resident Jack Lilly, followed by Gerald Holmes.
McCain.
How come?
I'm a veteran, and I feel that he supports the veterans better, and I'm just a little uncomfortable with Obama.
For Obama, I'm backing everything he's about, because that's the stuff that matters to me.
What is that stuff?
Stopping the war, for one, because I got family that goes over there. For one, that's one thing that means more to me than anything else.
Further west in Wake County, arguably the most liberal part of the state, Obama bumper stickers and yard signs are seen more often. It's home to the state capital Raleigh and the Research Triangle, Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill, three major universities speckled with smaller colleges in between. Michelle Yvette is a resident of Durham.
Obama.
How come?
I like him. I don't like McCain.
Or
Palin.
Yeah.
Even further west, the state again becomes more traditionally conservative. Baptist and evangelical churches dot the highway, and rural areas are well populated. In High Point, many voters are Republican and inclined to support McCain, including retiree Garland Knight.
Well, I think he's more of a leader than Barack Obama because he's not qualified to lead. He's not. He just don't have the experience.
But Obama is betting on voters like retiree Tom Dolan, also of High Point.
Well, I'm a lifelong Republican, and I'm voting for Obama.
Really?
Yes.
How come?
The Republicans are supposed to be financially conservative and have spent us into a hole, and you simply can't trust what they advocate anymore.
Obama has infused the state with $11 million in advertising, according to CNN, compared to McCain's $3 million. Obama has nearly 50 campaign offices, McCain a third of that. This political shift has benefited Kay Hagan, a Democratic state senator running for U.S. Senate. Hagan, who supports border security and inclined to oppose comprehensive immigration reform and also supports offshore drilling, is trying to beat Republican incumbent Elizabeth Dole. Dole is completing her first term, a seat she won after Republican Senator Jesse Helms retired after 30 years in office. Chris Lezak says political views shifting to Democrat still tend to be moderate.
A conservative Democrat is very difficult to tell from a moderate Republican in North Carolina. But people realize that she could be the 60th Senate vote. I mean, we know that. We've done the math. We know that could be Obama's. That could be the difference between Obama having to negotiate with those filibustering Republicans or with us actually being able to put Obama's plan in place without having to tack on their stuff. And that is gigantic.
North Carolina could assist the Democrats in regaining control of the White House, gaining a supermajority in the Senate, and gaining a broader majority in the House. For Free Speech Radio News in Greensboro, North Carolina, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Legislators on Capitol Hill continue to muddle through the financial crisis. The House Financial Services Committee met today to start the discussion on the future of financial services regulation.
You know, when this all started, the first thing that came to my head was Enron. And one of the things that I was thinking about was Enron, was where is the moral guide in our financial systems nowadays?
Representative Carolyn McCarthy of New York asked the financial experts gathered before the committee if there's a balance between overregulation and a lack of moral guidance.
Because I don't think there's anybody here that really wants to overregulate. We want the system to run smoothly.
Edward Yingling, president and CEO of American Bankers Association, said the financial sector needs an oversight regulator to oversee the economy and look for gaps and trends.
I think the problem is nobody has really been assigned to do that. In some ways, the Fed was supposed to do it, but we have not assigned anybody in our government to look at potential big problems.
Also speaking today was Columbia University professor and Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, who blamed the Federal Reserve for the financial crisis and argued that the government isn't yet on the right track to fixing the problems in the system. In his testimony, Stiglitz said, quote, "We know the boat has a faulty steering mechanism and is being steered by captains who do not know who to steer, least of all in these stormy waters. Unless we fix both, there is a risk that the boat will go crashing onto some other rocky shoals before reaching port." India and Pakistan have opened a trade route across the line of control in Kashmir for the first time since the region was divided between the two countries in 1947. Shahnawaz Khan traveled to the line of control to witness the first trucks rolling across the de facto border.
Carrying fruits, rice and spices, the first trucks crossed the line of control in Kashmir. Mazhar Naqvi from Muzaffarabad in Pakistani-administered Kashmir drove the first truck across the line of control through Aman Setu, or Peace Bridge, into Indian-administered Kashmir.
I am happy. I feel like I'm coming home,
This has been a dream since I was born.
The trucks aren't carrying a lot of goods. They're small because of weight restrictions on the bridge connecting two sides of Kashmir. But the people driving them are still enthusiastic. Tasleem Arif is another driver.
I cannot describe my happiness. It was a dream of our forefathers and we are fulfilling it.
In all, 13 small trucks crossed over from Indian side, while 14 trucks drove from Pakistani side at Peace Bridge. A few trucks also crossed over at another opening, connecting the towns of Poonch and Rawalpindi. The crossover will now be a weekly affair. While the crossing of small trucks with little merchandise seems symbolic, Kashmiri traders are hopeful that things will pick up. Mubin Shah heads the Kashmir Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
Now we feel excited about it, that physically now it is happening. Previously it was only on paper, now we are physically seeing it. And now making it substantiative will need certain things to be done. And we are hoping that this will, within a period of 3 months, all the small problems or will, you know, be overcome.
The impediments are in the form of restrictions and required formalities. The traders want free trade across the LOC, but for now they cannot even accompany their consignments. Telecommunication barriers are also a hurdle, as despite a four-year-old peace process and confidence-building measures by India and Pakistan, one cannot make calls from Indian administered Kashmir to other side of Kashmir in Pakistan. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan from the Line of Control in Kashmir.
A recent United Nations report found that as Israel continues to blockade the Gaza Strip, tunnels under the Gaza-Egypt borderline have increasingly become a lifeline for Gaza's population. FSRN's Rami Amigari files this report.
Some call the tunnels the death trade because dozens have died during construction of the underground passages to Egypt. But tunnels trade has continued and grown as the Israeli blockade on Gaza goes on for more than 16 months now. People use the tunnels to bring essential supplies like food items, cooking gas, petrol, livestock and electric devices from the Egyptian territories nearby. Abu Yasser is a tunnel worker and father of 8 children who was transporting cooking gas.
Israel can besiege us the way it wants. We are here to bring gas and everything the people need. It is true that these goods are quite expensive, but at the end of the day, we are not allowing anyone to repress us.
Many markets in the Gaza Strip, including the Rafah's market, are filled with Egyptian-made or Egyptian-imported goods. Abu Jamal is a 40-year-old merchant of electric devices.
As a merchant, I feel comfortable, for I can find something to sell better than nothing. But in fact, I am not satisfied relying on smuggled goods. However, they impose this on us, Israel and America, and some Arabs impose this siege, so we have to rely on smuggling. Can you imagine? I buy my children smuggled clothes. They have forced an entire people to rely on smuggling.
Unofficial estimates from government and tunnel workers suggest that a few thousand men earn their living from smuggling goods at the Egypt-Gaza border lines in southern Gaza, despite the dangers of this work. Abu Muhammad is a tunnel contractor from the Khan Yunis city in southern Gaza. Abu Muhammad lost his brother and nephew during tunnel digging last summer.
After the death of my brother and nephew, I stopped working because I was completely depressed and sick. Every day they would phone me, seeking work, because everyone is idle. If you come here in the afternoon, you'll see many people seeking work. Suppose I stop working, how would these people live? I want to tell you something. I have become much more afraid of going to work now. What if someone working with me gets hurt? I feel like I have committed a sin.
The Hamas-led government has issued instructions to those working in smuggling in an effort to avoid more deaths. It has also imposed more restrictions on smuggling for fears of bringing in drugs or prohibited substances. Ihab al-Ghussein is a spokesperson of the Hamas-led Interior Ministry.
Everyone knows that the Gaza Strip is under a repressive siege where 1.5 million residents are in a big jail where there is no food, no items, no clothes, nothing actually. Therefore, we'd like to say that as long as the Palestinian people remain under siege, it is their right to find creative means to ease such a crisis, such as these tunnels, which the residents use to bring in essential commodities like food, clothes, and other things. But this is an exceptional situation that will definitely come to an end if the siege is lifted.
Israeli claims that tunnels are used to smuggle weapons to Palestinian armed factions in Gaza, and it blames the Egyptian authorities for not shutting down these tunnels. According to an Egyptian brokered ceasefire deal between Israel and Gaza-based factions, Israel was supposed to reopen commercial crossings like Karni, Sofa and Kosafim regularly, but so far it has not. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Rafah City.
And now, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Debating without debating. In the classic Bruce Lee film, Enter the Dragon, the Chinese character tricks an Australian character by showing him his martial arts style, described as the art of fighting without fighting. He tricks his opponent into getting into a tiny dinghy and then tosses the tow line into the sea, leaving him alone and bobbing while the main vessel speeds away. If you're nerdy enough to have actually sat and watched all the presidential debates between Arizona Senator John McCain and Illinois Senator Barack Obama, then perhaps you feel some kinship with the Australian character left bobbing on the sea, for what you witnessed was the art of debating without debating. First of all, despite the mountains of hype, the events were as dry as three-day-old toast. And that's because that's what the party and corporate sponsors of the debates wanted. No surprises, no change, and above all, no third parties. Therefore, you never saw nor heard Green Party candidates Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente, Independent Ralph Nader, Libertarian Bob Barr, or Texas Congressman Ron Paul. The debates were pre-planned, pre-packaged, and even pre-contracted events where seating, standing, camera shots, and even moderators are determined weeks, if not months, in advance. Bigwigs from both major political parties sign a contract that is confidential, and then the show goes on. And invariably, each major party candidate uses his debate time to state, restate, and restate ad infinitum his or her well-rehearsed talking point or stump speech, and democracy marches on. And while corporate scribes, who would be court jesters in another era, proclaim who said what, who looked more presidential, or who won, the only real winners were both political parties and broadcast networks, who once again passed off the scripted reality show as a debate. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback and suggestions at comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp and Vinod K. Joes. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puklo, Rose Katapchi, and Oscar Hernandez. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Aura Bogado.